Hello and welcome to what is now Season 5 of Pebble in the Pond podcast. My name is Sam Stewart and I am the CEO of the Australian and New Zealand Mental Health Association. Each year, ANZMHA hosts several leading mental health conferences which give us the opportunity to connect with incredible industry leaders, lived experience speakers, researchers, academics and frontline workers as they share fascinating stories and projects which are changing the face of mental health within our community. Listen in as we go one-on-one with these inspiring people and dive deep into their work. It is truly a privilege to bring you their stories. Our podcast episodes may contain content which could be triggering for some people. If you need support, please contact Lifeline on 131114 or visit the Get Help page on anzmh.asn.au. Join us for Pebble in the Pond each Tuesday and let's get into Season 5. Leanne is a psychologist, author, presenter, and advocate. In this episode, we talk about the digital service delivery of mental health support during the pandemic, as well as the advances in AI, and also the role that technology will play in the future of mental health. Leanne's also the author of Head First, Health Fast, The Smart Approach to Outwitting Body Issues and Sustaining Achievable Health, and we also touch on the importance of a healthy body image in today's society. Welcome, Leanne. Leanne Hall, thanks so much for spending some time with me and sharing your story, a bit of your journey and some insights with our listeners. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
Leanne, do you want to let our listeners know, I'm sure everybody's probably heard of you, but do you want to give us a bit of context, a bit of background? How did you first get into the space of mental health?
Wow. I guess probably I would have to go right back into my own teenage years. I grew up with my parents and my siblings and look, I put a lot of thought into this because it's a question that comes up quite a lot. And I think my interest was first sparked probably when my parents separated when I was 12. That was a very difficult time. I was in year six preparing for year seven. And what followed was several years of probably what could only be described as family turmoil with my dad coming and going and seeing the effect that had on my mom. And being the youngest of all my siblings, I was the one that was at home. I was the youngest by quite a lot. The sibling closest to me is 13 years older. And then I've got two older siblings. So I was very much the baby, very much the one at home. And I think probably when I reflect back, I feel like I took that responsibility to try and help mum. So I think I became quite attuned to her suffering and really kind of wanting to kind of figure out for myself, how can I make her feel better through the eyes of a young teenager? And I think with the struggles that mum had and the distress that she suffered, the depression that she suffered, a lot of that was projected onto me. So I held a lot of that and I didn't know what to do with it. So I had my own suffering because of that. So I think probably when I reflect back, what got me through were my siblings and also my friends, my peers are 100% what got me through. So that's where the interest sort of started. I don't know where I had the epiphany that I wanted to do psychology. I think I grappled with medicine, but I wasn't smart enough to do medicine.
It's tough.
Yeah, it's tough.
Course.
Yeah, but I had a while where I thought, no, I want to do medicine and yeah, figured out pretty quickly that that wasn't going to happen. So, but I've always been interested in mental health. I've always been the person that people come to for support. And I just kind of thought, well, maybe I could make a good contribution in that space. Yeah.
That's amazing. And it's interesting, isn't it, how people get into mental health. Like everyone's got their own journey, their own reasons for doing it in the first place. How do you feel growing up now as a kid versus to when you were growing up? I mean, at the time you, with yourself being a child, you probably didn't recognize, it was on reflection that you recognized there was some challenges that you were dealing with and trying to cope with. Do you think that awareness is better now? And do you think that people are more in tune with that to be able to try and cope with that or talk to people about it at the time rather than retrospectively?
Yes, I think there's definitely more awareness, which is great. I think we've still got a little way to go with stigma. I think that still is out there. It's better than it was, but we've still got a fair way to go. I think there's unique challenges for this generation that I didn't have. So I could switch off. So I could go home from school and literally switch off and then go to school the next day. And the social landscape was very much the same. These days, if you aren't on your device, if you aren't you know, in all the chat groups, if you aren't on Snapchat, if you're not following what's going on, then you could go to school the next day and the whole landscape could be completely different and you've got no idea what's going on. So there's a lot of anxiety around that for young people that wasn't there. I think the world's gotten smaller. I think we know more. We're more connected to things that are going on in Afghanistan, you know, Ukraine. So we know what's going on, climate change. So I think there's the broader macro stuff that I think has caused, you know, a lot more pressure on our young people than it ever did when I was young.
Let's talk about the pressure on parents. So, I mean, let's go back to your mum, for instance. She would have been going through some tough times. How do you equate parenting, I guess the pressures of parenting back when we were younger versus the parenting of today?
Yeah, there's pros and cons. I think the pros are certainly for women, there are more opportunities. My mum was a stay-at-home mother and she was amazing at that. And I think in my parents and their friends, it was very similar. So very traditional gender roles growing up, which, you know, I think now we're a little bit more progressive or a lot more progressive. However, there's still a lot of pressure on women to hold it all and hold that space as well. So yeah, I think the pressures on parenting now, obviously there's financial pressures. I mean, we can't ignore that. That's huge. So I think there are different pressures. I'd like to say in my naive way, I would look back and say, gosh, things were a bit simpler, but in other ways, they're a lot more challenging. It was much more difficult to separate. There are a lot of women that were in situations where they had no choice, they had to stay. So from that point of view, I think it was potentially very unsafe for a lot of families. And I think a lot of suffering that was unspoken, you know, back to what you said before, I think there is a bit more acceptance, but I think there was a lot of suffering behind closed doors.
Do you think that's to do with the culture of how we were brought up and the parents had out their parents brought them up as well? And do you think that culture, it's something that's not easy to change, but I feel like we're getting there a little bit?
Yeah. And I think if you think we're looking, what's that post-World War II, that sort of generation, the boomers, that they very much were raised through a very, very difficult, very, very difficult time. Yeah. So it was very tough for them. And I think sometimes they parented in a way that taught their children that you can't have everything and that, you know, you need to go without, and which isn't, I mean, that's true, but I think in some ways they maybe overdid that a little bit and raised a generation where they then did a backflip and then they wanted their kids to have everything because they didn't growing up. So, yeah.
And in your 20 years of being in the sector, or over 20 years of being in the sector in mental health as a professional, what have you found to be something that's really progressed during your time? Something that you think, wow, we're sort of, even though we're not quite there, what do you think is something you've been quite excited about when you look back over the last 20 years?
I would say probably we're more accepting of diversity than maybe when I was sort of growing up. So whether that's cultural diversity, LGBTQI+, you know, I think, you know, I look back in my years and I know I had a couple of girlfriends that came out when they were sort of in their mid-20s and I said to them, gosh, you know, and they said, there's no way we could have come out when we were in school. That was not an option.
No.
So, yeah, I think, you know, and even cultural diversity, I just heard on the news this morning that Fraser Island's been returned to its proper name, the Indigenous name. And I look at that and think, oh, that's so exciting because I think we're very, very, the wheels are turning very slowly. We've got a long way to go. But I see conversations like that and I'm very encouraged by all of that.
I guess coming into the mental health system, what are some things that you think have been challenging to deal with that you think, is it some systemic challenges that you think, hierarchical challenges? I'd be interested to get your thoughts on coming into the space. What have you noticed over your time that is something that you just think, man, this is clunky, or this just doesn't make sense?
I could talk about that all day. Got to be careful that I don't just rabble on about that. I get on a high horse when it comes to that. I think to put it simply, you know, I've worked for years in the system, being the mental health system, private practice and various other contexts, and increasingly felt that I didn't belong there and just felt frustrated, but I didn't know what I was frustrated at. I just knew that I'm part of the problem, not part of the solution. And it wasn't really until I started working at Youth In Search that it clicked for me that this is what's missing. It's peer-to-peer. And I think what the system has done is it's put mental health within a medical model. So it's what's wrong with you instead of what's happened to you. And the questions are around, what pigeonhole can I put you in? What are your symptoms? What's the label that I can put on you so that as an expert health professional, I can then fix you because you're broken. And that's the bit that I just did not wash with me. And over many, many years of seeing people suffering because of what's happened to them, the systems that they're a part of, whether it's disadvantage, whether it's just a, you know, family system that's got a lot of conflict. And then young people that are presenting within a medical model and being told that you have a label, you have depression, you have this. And they identify as that then, and they go through their life thinking that they're broken and they need to be fixed. Doesn't sit well with me at all.
Yeah, and there's an important distinction between from the clinical professional side of things with the label and the pigeonholing with the how to treat and how to so-called fix people. But then from the actual client's perspective, from the consumer, what effect have you seen that have on people?
Oh, look, I've seen people that are experienced trauma from the system. So, you know, I think back to one of the standouts for me was a young person I saw who was quite distressed, and she went to an inpatient unit, and, you know, she was 13 and turned up to this unit and wasn't allowed to have her mother in the room with her. She was acutely distressed and she was about to be admitted. And they said, no, that's not healthy. That's an unhealthy attachment that you need to have your mother here. And the mother tried to advocate and say, I just want to be there for my daughter. And she was labelled as being unhelpful, and the system was called enmeshed. And so this young person then had to sit in with two complete strangers in the most horrible of circumstances under her distress, and with the belief that these professionals believe that my relationship with my mum is unhelpful and that this isn't helping me. It took me over 18 months to unravel that in private practice. So again, I was part of the system in a way, but very much identified that as something that was incredibly traumatic for this family. So that's an example of what the system can do.
And quite rightly, it shouldn't happen in the first place.
No, not at all. She was 13.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
from a perspective of the peer workforce. Let's talk about that a little bit. And we're seeing that getting taken a lot more seriously than it has been in the past, which is great. And there's opportunities for peer workforce to come through now. It feels like more than ever in history, but certainly heading in the right direction. You advocate for peer workforce. You're a big believer in lived experience and having that involvement throughout the process. I'd love to hear it from your point of view and where you think this could head and the benefits it could help have on people.
I think you're right. There's a lot of traction now with lived experience, peer workforce. The problem is we recognise an immediacy to build this workforce quickly. We need it rapidly because we know that there are a lot of people that aren't able to access more traditional conventional services. We also know for young people, a lot of them don't trust adults. So, you know, they will trust their peers, but they won't trust adults. So we know there's an immediacy. The government knows, both sides of government, state, federal. We've done a lot of lobbying. They're all on board with it. We haven't had to convince anybody of the value of a lived experience peer workforce. The problem is that the infrastructure isn't there yet. So we're building something but flying it at the same time. So we recognise the need. We recognise that this needs to expand quickly. But what we're playing catch up with is the frameworks around that and the safety and the we talk about accreditation. But my reluctance in that language is kind of saying, well, we're almost using the same language. We're almost, you know, kind of thinking of this peer workforce and putting them back into the medical model, which is not what we want either.
Yeah. What do you think is probably what's the best solution for this? Like, how do you think moving forward, on one hand, you think, okay, we need to try and have some sort of a baseline of how to go about things perhaps, or a standard, but then how do we try and bring that in without, like you say, making it hard for people that have been through their experience and they have so much to give and offer for people that are going through something perhaps very similar to what they went through. I'd just be interested. I don't know what the solution is, but I mean, without going down that path of accreditation, but I'd be interested to get your thoughts on that.
Well, what we don't need are a bunch of experts with clinical experience telling the peer workforce what they need.
Yes.
That's what we don't need. We need it to come from peer workers themselves. What do you need in order to do your work effectively? I think that's where we need to start. And I think that's missing a little bit. I hear lots of discussions of people talking about peak bodies and accreditation. And I think this needs to come from peer workers, and it needs to come from those people that have accessed peer workers and found that contact and that support very, really helpful. What worked? We're doing that research on the ground now. So what we're trying to unpack with Youth In Search is, what is the experience of young people that are supported by a peer worker? What's it like for them? What's it like for a peer worker? So really trying to get that experience on the ground of what those experiences are like. And I think from there, then you can start to build a framework that's helpful rather than impose an existing framework that isn't designed for peer work. It's designed for clinical services. It's designed for medical services. We've got to stop looking at, we need randomized controlled trials and we need, you know, systemized kind of ways of practicing and manuals and treatments. And we've got to move away from that kind of language.
Yeah, more humanized, you reckon?
Absolutely more humanized, more grounded in experience rather than numbers and that kind of thing. Yep.
The Youth In Search Foundation, can you explain to our listeners what that is and what it does?
Yeah, so Youth In Search has been around since the mid-1980s. So it started as a volunteer-based model for young people within a community in northwestern Sydney who basically sort of sat around and said, this existing way of support is not working. We want to be able to help each other. So what developed was a program that was actually designed by young people for young people. So it was run by volunteers, weekend workshops, weekly support groups within communities, delivered by young people who had been through our program and then were trained up to become youth leaders. So we provide the 12 months of training for them to actually become leaders and deliver the program. Probably in the last sort of 5 years, our new CEO, or he's not new anymore, but our CEO decided that we need to move to a place-based model where we can actually put social workers within those communities to provide that more intensive support. So we sort of evolved from there. We're now at a point with funding from the federal government through National Suicide Prevention, where we've employed lived experience peer workers in 6 communities across Queensland, Victoria, and New South Wales to deliver that one-on-one peer support to young people in the communities and facilitate their attendance at the weekend workshops and the support groups as well.
Wow. So the initial concept came about during the 80s?
Yeah.
Wow, that seems very progressive.
Yes, it was. What happened was it was at a community called Riverston in northwest Sydney. Yeah, northwest Sydney. And essentially what they did is the young people that came to those programs were tended to be those young people that were in the system, juvenile justice, out-of-home care. And after the program started being delivered in that community, the police closed the shop front. They didn't need it. The crime rates just went almost to zero. Youth crime. Yeah. So from that, there were lots of media coverage, 60 Minutes, and then many communities popped up and said, wow, we want this in our community.
So how do you scale it? Because as you said, it's something that's working, but it's going to take resources. You're getting some funding from the government and you're saying that there is now geographically, it has expanded into a few of the other states.
Yeah.
How do we get this program to the people that need it most?
You're right. It's funding. We've got the model. We've tested it. We're doing it. We've worked in that peer-to-peer space since the mid-80s, which is extremely progressive. So I don't know many organisations that can say they've been running peer-to-peer work for that amount of years. Well, that's only 40 years. So we've worked with the lived experience young people for 40 years. So we're absolutely ready to scale. We just need the funding to do it. So, and not only that, but we're rolling out a program now with federal government funding where we're wrapping a very, very robust evaluation around it. So we'll have an avoided cost model. We'll have some participatory action research by lived experience researchers. We'll have all of the evidence to kind of say, look, these are the experiences and this is why it works. So, but I mean, I guess our philosophy is you've just got to get in there and do it. There are young people that are struggling. The suicide rate's not going down. Mm. You know, we've got some alarming rates of distress among our young people in Australia, particularly regional rural areas, which is where we focus. Mm. So we've got a model that can access them tomorrow. We just need the funding.
How are you finding the funding? Are you finding this still quite complex to work through and navigate, or do you feel like it's getting easier?
I think we've had some very, very incredible philanthropy donations, and we've got some donors that are incredible supporters of ours, and that they've really enabled us to get to where we are. It's been philanthropy funding that's done it. We've got some very, very generous donors that are very big supporters. With the government funding, the problem is with peer work, it's not medical model. So it doesn't fit in a health budget. It doesn't fit in a social services budget. It doesn't fit in a disabilities budget. So we've got some systemic problems there with the way these sorts of programs are funded. Everybody says, yeah, it's great, but it doesn't fit in our box.
Yeah.
So it becomes a question for Treasury.
It's a common theme, isn't it? This whole fitting into a box and really making quite a narrow focus. And if you either fit the criteria or you don't, similar diagnosis for people as well.
That's right.
Are we looking at something that needs to be a lot more dynamic? Are we looking for something that, I mean, let's go back to that conversation about labeling and pigeonholing with people with a diagnosis. What do you think is the best way moving forward to try and assist those people with a mental ill health challenge?
I think it's really about looking at that question I said before. It's what's happened to you, not what's wrong with you. So we need to shift our focus to more of that sort of trauma-informed, healing-focused language rather than that sort of top-down, expert-driven approach. So, you know, there's been researchers and physicians around the world that know this. They know that a lot of the ailments that we see, even things like cancers, you know, it's not that they're caused by mental health, but there's such huge overlap. So I think we've got to stop thinking that the mind and body are separate. So it's really about having that holistic kind of view of where are you feeling that in your body and what are the circumstances and systems around you that have contributed to this. So it's a language, it's changing our language, but it's changing our focus. We've got to stop looking within the person for the answer and looking at what's going on around them. The answer is already there, but we've got to stop assuming that it sits within that person, that the problem sits within that person, because it's not. We're part of multiple systems, and it's the interactions and the relationships that we have that really need to be brought into that discussion.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting conversation. How do you think we're going with this? Do you think we're close to trying to get the attention that it needs to get some momentum behind a bit of a shift or a bit of a change? Are we getting the right people in front of, you know, where the message needs to be heard?
I think we are gaining momentum. So we're definitely moving in the right direction. I'm impatient. I'd like it all to happen tomorrow. but yes, I think there are, you know, coming to conferences, you know, like this one and other conferences, I can see that there are a lot of people doing this kind of work in similar ways. So there is definitely momentum. I think it's also not about saying that what the current model isn't working. I think it does work. So it's certainly also not about saying, let's get rid of the medical model and take mental health completely out of the medical model and do something different. It's really just about saying that medical answer isn't the only answer. I'm an advocate for mental health. Sometimes people need medication. They need medical support. Absolutely they do. So it's not an either or.
Yeah.
And it's the same to government. You know, they've been investing in programs for years that particularly for young people that have been doing some great stuff for young people. It's not about saying stop investing in those programs, but it's about saying broaden your focus.
Yeah.
Look at all those young people that aren't suitable for those programs and what's something complementary that could sit alongside that. So it's not that hard. We're not asking for radical change. We're just asking for a broader scope.
No, thanks for clearing that up, and that makes sense. If we look at the youth, as far as the Youth In Search Foundation, what's the definition of youth or young people?
In terms of the young people, we support 12 to 24.
Okay.
So our workshops generally are for 14 to 20, mainly because some of the language, you know, developmentally, those sort of, there's a big difference between 12 and 16 and 17. But yeah, we look at, yeah, from school age, 12 to 18 and a bit beyond.
And if you look at the challenges that our youth are facing, which can be quite different depending on where you live, the environment you're growing up in, the support you may have or may not have, but tell us a little bit about the struggles of being a youth today and some of the challenges that you're seeing that you guys are trying to help people.
We see a lot of young people that come from significant disadvantage. So a lot of poverty, a lot of domestic violence, some young people from out-of-home care. So we have a big cohort of young people that have grown up, you know, in those kinds of circumstances. So there's a lot of trauma. So around 80 to 90% of the young people we see have experienced significant trauma as a child, and it's complex trauma. And then often they have experiences where they don't feel they fit in. So we also have, you know, a large cohort of LGBTQI+ young people, Indigenous young people, around 20% Indigenous, because we work a lot in those more regional areas. So these are often young people that have been up against a lot of systemic disadvantage and then family disadvantage, and then they've internalized a lot of that and have, you know, experiences of their own distress, a lot of suicidal distress as well.
And the statistics aren't going in the right direction, are they?
No, they're not. And we said to government 2 years ago, we said, look, we're in the middle of a pandemic, or we're just coming out of it. The real problem is 2-3 years later, and we're starting to see that. I think we've had an increase in rates of suicide in Victoria. We're starting to see that slow, but it's creeping up. The real worry is that that's going to start to kind of happen in other states as well. If you think of Victoria, in a way, really caught the brunt of a lot of the COVID lockdowns and pandemics. The worry is that if we don't act now, we're going to see an increase in distress and suicide, particularly among our young people.
And when you say act, trying to get the resources to get the programs out to the right people.
Absolutely. We need to access those young people that are in areas where there aren't services or where, you know, they have a lot of barriers to seeking support.
Was the foundation able to still continue to deliver services during COVID?
We were. I started working for the organisation at that time, which that was a challenge. Yeah. So they literally pivoted to an online delivery overnight. It was extraordinary. So we already had ways of working as a team online. We already used that sort of technology. So we had the infrastructure there, which was lucky. We didn't have to develop that, but we started delivering our workshops online, support groups online. It wasn't ideal, but at least we were still able to capture those young people that really needed it.
Yeah. So when you say it wasn't ideal, the delivery method of a digital delivery for services, not as effective, do you think, than face-to-face?
No. Yeah. In my experience, healing happens within relationships and that needs to be face-to-face. So you will be able to deliver something online. And I think there's a lot of programs that they're purely online delivery. And again, they're very useful, but you're not going to get the sort of healing that we see our young people, you know, progress to the healing that they achieve. It's actually through relational experiences.
Leanne, I'd love to get your thoughts on the digital space and AI. It's such a progressive part of the world at the moment. AI and technology, it's developing quite quickly. Where do you see this? How do you see this playing out in mental health or service delivery? And do you think it's an asset, or do you think it could be something that may not help?
I'm worried about it at the moment because I think it's progressing too quickly. I think even Elon Musk said we need to slow down. He might have an interest in saying that, to be honest, be fair. But the problem is the advances are so rapid, but the ethics around we don't have that yet. So the real danger of it seeping into mental health is that we haven't had those ethical discussions about what are the implications, what does this mean? We haven't had that yet. And that's a real, real worry. I can see its benefits, but at this point, my thinking around that is to augment existing face-to-face human support. We can't take the human out of it. That's a dangerous space. If we're going to start taking the human part out of mental health support, I think that's a real worry.
And if we look at the role that technology is playing, there's certainly some positives and certainly going to be here to stay, not going away anywhere soon. From the youth perspective, we're still seeing some really challenging statistics, really alarming behaviors that are still happening online, cyberbullying. There's no off switch for people, like you mentioned earlier. How do you think parents cope with those challenges in today's world?
Well, I think some parents are all over the technology. They're fairly tech savvy and they know what their kids are doing online, but there's another group of parents that don't get it and they don't know what their kids are doing online. And then there's obviously a group in the middle somewhere, but I'm probably in the middle somewhere if I'm honest. But I think as parents, we have to educate ourselves on what our kids are doing. And as hard as it is to try and keep up with all the new platforms, we have a responsibility to as parents, and not just parents, but as a community. I hear a lot of people say, oh, it's on the parents to know what their kids are doing. It's not just the parents, it's communities. You know, we need to support each other. We need to support our parents as much as we need to support our young people. So I don't think it's right to put the responsibility just on parents. You know, I think this is, I say it all the time, we've lost the village. You know, whatever happened to looking after your neighbour and knowing, you know, what supports your people across the road need, that kind of thing. Family, our idea of family needs to broaden to include all of that. So yeah, I think it's about everybody being educated, everybody taking responsibility to know what our young people are doing online.
Even the schools as well. Like, I mean, it's just so blurred their responsibility these days. If there's things happening in chats and it's involving school kids, but then it's outside of school, but it seems more complex these days about whose responsibility it is. But in a way, you're quite right, aren't you, that it's everybody needs to take some responsibility and ownership.
Yeah. And some aspects of online and social media, it's fabulous. It's not the devil either. It's not all bad. So, you know, certainly for young people, it's an amazing way to stay connected and catch up with your friends. I see, you know, my kids will message each other on the weekend or oh yeah, I got a message or a snap from so-and-so, I'm going to go over to his house. And it's a lovely way to supplement and augment the relationships that you already have. The problem is when young people are using it and they're not in a good headspace. that's where the real danger is. But if they're fairly well connected and they're in a fairly good headspace, I think it's got some marvellous advantages.
Leanne, what are some things, if I shift the focus to you, what are some things for well-being that you undertake to keep yourself well?
Probably the big thing for me is exercise. So yeah, it's a way to sort of burn off that kind of adrenaline and, you know, to sort of de-stress. And also I just, when I'm sort of running or I'm at the gym, then I've just got my own thoughts and my music, I suppose. So music's a big thing for me. It's huge. And I think the two go hand in hand, the exercise and music. Yeah, I love spending time with my family. I love, you know, sitting down with my husband overnight and having a glass of wine and watch something on TV and having a chat. So, you know, anything that just gets me out of my head, I think I find I have to. Otherwise, I notice it. If I haven't exercised for a while, if I, you know, haven't been able to kind of spend that time with my family, I start to get irritable. I start to get edgy. And I know for me, oh gosh, I'm not my best self.
Yeah. And it can be quite a challenge sometimes, especially people working in the sector, to unwind, to unravel, and to actually take care of themselves.
Yeah. Yes. I think we've got to remind ourselves that we can't be all things to all people, that, you know, it is okay to say no, that if you're not in a good headspace yourself, then how can you possibly be in that? How can you possibly support other people? How can you be there for other people? I see a lot of people take too much on. They take multiple roles. And it comes from a really good place. But sometimes I think also there's a reluctance to be quiet and still. I really worry about that as a society. I think we're so busy doing things that we don't spend enough time in silence. And I wonder sometimes whether there's a bit of a global fear about that, being still, being quiet. What might happen if I do that? Yeah.
It's a good point. I'd like to get your take on organizations and the role they play today. We're seeing a bit of an awakening. We're seeing organizations, corporates, businesses start to not only take mental health a bit more seriously, but shift the focus from just leave your troubles at the door when you come in. It seems to be, we're seeing a bit of a shift in that where they're looking at going down the pathway of taking a more holistic view and trying to almost now become an employer of choice based on some of the well-being initiatives that they might be undertaking. Are you seeing some great ideas? Are you seeing the roles that organizations are playing in mental health and wellness in people's lives improve?
Yeah, definitely. I know just in my immediate family, some of my nieces and nephews work in organizations where they're very proactive in that space, but they tend to be driven by young CEOs and young executives that really kind of get it, which is great to see. It's fantastic. And so I sometimes think that movement towards exactly what you're saying is driven more by our younger generation, not so much by people my age. It's out there, but not quite as much, which is a bit of a shame. Yeah, that stoicism, we seem to be pushing back on that stoicism and realizing that you can't leave your problems at the door. You know, if you have a massive fight at home and then you rock up to work the next morning, of course you're going to have that with you. So it's very heartening to see that organizations are starting to, you know, support their staff and try and understand what they need. And I guess that sort of, I guess, really starts to challenge that stigma as well.
Leanne, you've authored a book. Do you want to tell our listeners the name of the book, where they can get it, and then also how they can get in touch with you if they want to know more?
Yeah, it's called Head First, Health Fast, The Smart Approach to Outwitting Body Image Issues. So I wrote this in 2017. It was a bit of a former life where I was working a lot in that space around mind-body health. Mm-hmm. More well-being in that sort of well-being space. So, you know, I do have qualifications as a personal trainer in fitness as well. So I sort of brought all of that together and I have a, you know, history working in the area of eating disorders. So it was really a combination bringing all that together. I ran some programs for inpatients around what healthy eating is and really resisted that idea that people that are suffering from these kinds of experiences shouldn't exercise. And I said, no, that doesn't make sense to me. I think there's a way of actually reconnecting with your body that you can do through exercise. So, yeah, it's really, I guess, a guide for how to really start to challenge some of those, you know, cultural issues around body, how to reconnect with your body in a way that isn't about punishing it, but it's about doing something that's good for it, but also recognizing that sometimes we do that because of underlying trauma and various other experiences. So just bringing it all together into something that's a bit more holistic and a lot more forgiving and a lot more flexible, which is what we need with no diets.
Yes.
No diets.
Yes. In fact, body image is something that's really important, isn't it? And still quite topical.
Yeah. And I do think that systemically and culturally, there is a disconnect that we have with our bodies at the moment. Maybe some of that's influenced by that medical model. So there's a separation that's kind of happened. And I think what we need is to really, you know, start to lean into some of those Eastern philosophies that have been, and Indigenous, you know, practices that have been around for absolute centuries. You know, we can't just throw all that out because we think medicine has the answer. I think we need to start bringing some of those ideas back.
I agree. Leanne, how can people get a hold of you if they want to know more?
Probably Instagram.
Yep.
Leanne Hall Therapist. That's my handle. I'm on Facebook. That's probably the best way.
And you have a really good website too.
I do have a website. Forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me. Yes. www.leannehall.com.
I think it is.
I don't even know.
let me check. Yes. No. It. Yeah, it is. .com.au.
Yeah, that's
LeanneHall.com.au.
Thank you.
Leanne, thanks so much for your time. It's been really great to have a chat with you and get your thoughts on a lot of different topics and issues. So I appreciate your time and thanks very much for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to share with your friends and colleagues. And if you know someone working in mental health that you'd like to see featured on the podcast, please email any suggestions to us at membership@anzmh.asn.au. You can also stay up to date on our socials at ANZMHA on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to sharing our next episode with you next week.